are in the middle of this source sheet, the source sheet that arbitrarily lists 17 at the top of it. It's not completely arbitrary, but it's close to arbitrary. We're about 17, somewhere between 17 and 20. At least class is, not sure about source sheets. But we're in the middle of talking about abusive parents. Hopefully this is one of those things we'll never have to apply. But, you know, like they say about the Ben Sorer Amore, right? Lo haya v'lo niya. Lo yiya. It's never happened, and hopefully it will never happen. Rather, drosh v'kabel schar. Learn about it, and you'll get reward for learning it. So hopefully also, when it comes to the topic of abusive parents, we'll also only be able to get the reward for learning it, but not for applying it. Okay. We had quoted last week from a couple different sources. We first of all pointed out that this is not a new concept to us in this class, because we've already talked about, first of all, the month beforehand, before we started this topic, we've been talking about when there's a tug of war between the Torah and the parent, whether it be you know, something you have to do versus something your parents want you to do, whether it be something your parents tell you to do, which is itself against the Torah. And then now, and really we already started this topic also before, when the parent wants you to do something which is against the Torah, thereby they disqualify themselves as the as deserving of kavod, as deserving of the honor of kibud av v'aim. We quoted another source that we've talked about before, which was Avram Avinu. Avram was told that he has a special exemption. Everybody else has the obligation to honor their parents, except for Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu was allowed to go to Eretz Yisrael, despite the fact that it meant leaving his parents, meaning Terach specifically, at least that's the explicit parents mentioned in the Torah. Do we know Terach's wife's name? Avram's mother? This would be a great time to have Reina with us. Unfortunately, Reina is sitting Shiva. For those who don't know how to get in touch with her, so please look at the Shul email or ask me so you can make a Shiva call, either over the phone or even in person with proper precautions. But the Medrash actually tells us in a different place that Avram was not only leaving his father, but he did so after a very important and very significant scene, a very significant episode, where his father basically reported him to Nimrod. Right, report him to Nimrod after Avram broke the idols. We all know the story. He claimed it was the biggest idol that did it and whatever. And his father, Terach, brings him to Nimrod in order to be tested. And Nimrod actually puts him in the fire. So we said that maybe this is an indication that there is some kind of there's some kind of abuse going on in the home, that Nimrod was that Terach was bringing him to Nimrod sort of to be put on trial. And ultimately, the next few psukim say lech lecha. The next few psukim is when this other midrash in source number 2 comes, where he says that. As you can see, source number 3 is Perek Lamed Ches, and source number 2 is Perek Lamed Tes. So they're right after one another. And nonetheless, the midrash says that Avram Avinu would be obligated to respect Terach, despite the fact that the measures right beforehand said that he reported him to the authorities. He gave him over to Nimrod, who tried to kill him. So that's just an interesting combination of midrashim that we all know, but didn't necessarily appreciate. That is how it's relevant to this topic. But as we've said back then, as we're saying now, that's a gadata. It's midrash. We can't necessarily learn from there. Because, as we know, the Midrash Rabbah is teaching us stories or backgrounds, not giving us halachas, not making drushes. Making drushes, but not in the drusha sermon sense, not in the drusha exegesis sense. So, we went into the actual Gemaras. The Gemaras that are actually referring to the obligations of Kibud Av V'Aim. We talked about the Gemara in Kiddushin Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph. This is in source number 4, where we had a story of Dama ben Nesina. We talked about there's a bit of a differentiation. There are different commentaries that say, was it referring to Rav Dimi? Was it talking about Dama ben Nesina? We already told the story of Dama ben Nesina with the gem that he had under his father's pillow, but did not wake his father up. So we have another story about Dama ben Nesina, potentially, at least according to Rashi, it's about Dama ben Nesina, where his mother comes over to him while he is in the middle of all these Roman nobility, you know, nobility. Is nobility a word? I don't think so. Maybe. Nobility? Mincy? Yes or no? Nobility is the word I was thinking of, but is nobility also a word?
No.
No? I don't know. I feel that there might be a context for that. Not in the way I'm saying it, but not... but
that's not
for
us. I don't know.
Either way, we can do that in our dictionary class. But so the Gemara says here that he's among the nobility of Rome. His mother comes over, rips off his clothing, and this was like the special Roman, you know, nobleman clothing, and smacks him in the face and spits in his face, and he didn't do anything to her. What is that, Esther? What are you telling me? It's not a word? No? All right. We'll have to, maybe it's a Shakespeare word. Okay, so Domo ben Asina was part of the nobility of Rome, and he was nonetheless, he held himself back from chastising his mother, from embarrassing his mother. She embarrassed him. An abusive parent relationship, it would seem, at least an abusive episode, where the mother is there. And nonetheless, the Gemara, Chazal, is bringing this as a story, not to tell us some crazy story that has nothing to do with the obligations of the Kibbud Av V'Aim, but presumably to teach us something about Kibbud Av V'Aim, that even when a parent is abusive to a child, so you have to respect them. Now, it doesn't say that explicitly, which always leaves open the open room for interpretation about whether or not this is halacha lemaisa, or this is sort of like Dama ben Asina said before, sort of like the paradigm, the ultimate example of kibbud av v'aim, but not necessarily that you'd be obligated to do so, but rather that this is something we can all learn from, we can aspire to. But nonetheless, what it does show us, and this is something relevant to the last topic that we spoke about, that there is a notion of kibbud av v'aim even when your parent is not, you know, 100% deserving of it, right? There's still such a mitzvah. It's not like they're completely, they're in different ballparks. We had then said, we had then seen in a source, in source number 7, that Tosfos makes the, makes this case very different, right? The Tosfos says in source number 7, Yesh b'midrash, Shahaisa miturefes midata. The woman had become senile. The mother of Dama ben Asina was not 100% all there. And therefore, that completely changes the Gemara. Because maybe if there was a woman who was completely in her right mind and she was making a calculated decision to abuse her child, so maybe that would be one situation where that situation the child would not have to respect his mother. But if the mother has gone crazy, and she's lost her mind, she's coming senile, maybe she has Alzheimer's, whatever it might be, and then she hits her child, so it's not really that she's undeserving of kavod. She is not in control of that situation, and therefore she doesn't lose the opportunity or the obligation, she doesn't lose the honor of that's due to her from her child. We talked last week at the beginning of the class about whether or the difficulty, we talked about the difficulty of how to draw that line. Where do we draw the line between what the parent is in control of, what the parent is not in control of? Because obviously there's always going to be a reason why somebody does something bad to somebody, right? It's never just out of the blue and random, but it's always, there's always some kind of preceding incident or mental faculty that's causing you to do such a thing. So in this case, it's unclear what we're supposed to learn from it. Maybe what we're supposed to learn is that even a parent who has become senile, has sort of lost their faculties, you still have the obligation to respect them. Maybe that's what we're supposed to learn. But again, it's unclear how exactly we're supposed to take this Gemara. We saw another Gemara that sounds very similar, or at least points in a similar direction, I should say. And that is the Gemara in Moed Katan. The Gemara in Moed Katan says that the Shifcha of Beis Rebbe, the maidservant of Rebbe, once chastised or tried to excommunicate a person that was in Rebbe's house. Unclear who this person was. But Chazisei Lahu Gavra Dehava Machil Ibnu Agadol Amra Lehave Hahu Gavra Bishmaisa Bishamta. This person was hitting his older son, And she said that this person should be excommunicated because he's being over the Isser. He is violating the principle of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol. You're putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person. And we had asked last week, what is the stumbling block? Who's the blind person? What's the stumbling block? Presumably, as Rashi tells us, the issue is, or as this paraphrasing tells us in the translation here, the son is likely to become angry and strike his father back, thereby transgressing the severe prohibition against hitting one's parent. But wait a second. If the parent is hitting the child, so then maybe this is abuse, and maybe the child would not be obligated. Why would there therefore be an issue of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol? We said maybe it's because, as we wanted to say first and foremost in source number 4, that one still has an obligation towards respecting their parent, despite the abuse that might be going on. That is the possible implication here. If you look at source number 6, the Ritva has something to tell us. The Ritva tells us, in source number 6, B'maka b'no agadu ha-kasuf. So, what does that mean? The story was interesting just by itself, but then it adds this quality of b'no ha-gadol. Right, the older son. What's a b'no ha-gadol? How would you define b'no ha-gadol? Anyone know?
On bar mitzvah, someone who's...
Good. Typically, when the Gemara or the Mishnah uses the word gadol, it connotes bar mitzvah ages. I don't know about you, but there are a bunch of bar mitzvahs coming up in our shul. Not all of them will be featured in our shul, but I've had 3 meetings this week with bar mitzvah kids. Kanai Nahara. She still keep having them. But usually gadol means someone who is of mitzvah observance and thereby obligatory. Getting some feedback here. Trying to figure out who that is. Might be Estelle. Okay. We'll see here in the Ritva, he actually takes that to another level. No, it wasn't Estelle. Okay. Perish says the Ritva in source number 6, Af bezeh hakasav medaber. Meaning, even though... Is it me? I'm getting some feedback. I don't know what it is. Even though they want the father wanted to teach his child something, right? This was not just randomly he came over and hit him, like it sounded like in source number 5, in source number 4, but he was trying to liyasro. Liyasro, for those of you who are in my Mishle class, or ever come to a Mishle class, you come. Sometimes we have this word liasro. It's from the word musar. It means to discipline. The father was trying to discipline his child, even though that was the case. He's nonetheless held responsible for lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. Says the Ritva, very interesting idea. Vinir in devarim delo gadol gadol mamish. We're not talking about literally a gadol, an older child. Ella hakol lefi tivo, everything according to their nature. Sheyesh lachu sheyitarim. I don't know what that word means. Sheyitrim kenegdo b'dibor o b'masav. What is that word? Yitrim. It might be a misprint.
Kvas.
What?
Kvas.
No. Sheyitarem kenegdo.
Where is Reina when we need her?
Yeah, right. Sheyitrem kenegdo b'dibor o b'masav. Yitrem. I don't know. Not sure. But either way, Yitrem kenegdo b'dibor o b'masav ki afilu lo yehe bar mitzvah. Even if he wasn't bar mitzvah, and he's not obligated in mitzvot yet, ein ra'oy lahavio le'demaka. The parent is not, it's not appropriate for the parent to bring even a child who's less than bar mitzvah age to hitting or to cursing. Omakal aviv shelo yish tadlanu bedvarim umishum deorcha demilsa begadol shchiach ki nakad begadol. Meaning the Torah, the Gemara doesn't literally mean gadol, doesn't mean literally mean adult child, but typically that's when we would expect the child to fight back. This is a huge what. You know, it does mean donate, but that doesn't make sense here. like Truma would be to donate, right? We talked about that on Tuesday. But Yitzraim here doesn't sound like that would make any sense. Yeah, no, it's going to bother me. But either way, the statement from the Ritva here is startling. Because what does it mean? The Ritva is saying, right, if you remember the Gemara said that this woman was trying to excommunicate this guy because he hit his son. What's so bad about hitting his son? Because the son's now going to retaliate, and therefore the father is obligated in lifnei ivelo sitein mechshol. Now let me ask you, if I were to, I don't know, bring a child to do some kind of iser which they're not obligated in, would that be considered putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person? Right. Let's say I give a child. I don't want to say cheeseburger or something like that, because that gets a little bit dicey with other issues. But the let's say I put him in front of a light switch on Shabbos, right? So is that considered lifnei iver on my part? Presumably not, because lifnei iver requires that whatever act that I'm soliciting, whatever act that I'm causing, is itself a transgression. Right, it has to be a stumbling block. If you're a child who's less than bar mitzvah, so then what's the stumbling block? Right, if you're not obligated in the mitzvah, so how could the Ritva now say that it's usher for the child to hit his father back if he's not bar mitzvah yet?
I would think of a case like I can't remember the book, but Fagin's teaching of kids how to be pickpockets.
Okay.
Got a pickpocket or two.
Okay, and what does that have to do with this?
So training youngsters.
Okay.
You mean an Oliver Twist?
Yeah, Oliver Twist, right. Good for you, Sarita. I mean, training kids to a life of crime.
Yeah.
Which actually was a kind of occupation for some people.
Uh-huh.
Pickpockets. So it is, even if a child's less than bar mitzvah age, if you're training them in the wrong way, mm-hmm. that you're setting them up, putting a stumbling block before them, because you're setting them off in bad habits, which they will be accountable for in a very short while, when they are bar mitzvah.
Okay, specifically in terms of rebelling against their parent, that's the mitzvah that you're training them in to transgress. Okay, that's interesting. But it is important to point out that according to the Ritva, whatever the problem is, it applies to children, and this is very important for our concept, our discussion here about abusive parents. Because sometimes maybe you'll think, well, do I have to be mechabe my father and mother who are abusive? Well, I'm not bar mitzvah yet, so I don't have to. Here it's saying that maybe the child is still obligated in kibud av v'aim, because that's why the father wouldn't be able to hit the child, lest the child do it back. Kind of an interesting statement. But nonetheless, we have two Gemaras here that both basically say that the child is in some ways obligated towards a parent who seems to be abusive. And that's a little bit striking. If you look at the Rambam in source number 8, we'll get into it a little bit more. V'hamakeh b'no gadol minadin oso. If someone hits their older child, clearly the Rambam does not agree with the Ritva in source number 6, because he makes a point of saying gadol. Minadin oso sheharehu over al v'lifne yivlo sitin mechshol, he's putting a stumbling block. However, and this is how the Rambam seems to say the same as the Tosvos, mishen nitrefa dato shel aviv o shel imo. Let's say your parent goes crazy. Mishtada linhog imam kefi datam ad shiruchem aleihem. It seems to Paskin like Dama ben Nasina, that he, even though his mother was embarrassing him, he didn't embarrass her back. That you have to basically say, you have to have mercy on them until you can no longer deal with it. Because he then says, v'im e'ef sharlo, la'amod b'mneishnish tatu b'yoser. If it's impossible to sort of stay with your parents, they've gone too off the rails, they're just too senile, maybe they're abusive in some way, so then b'yoser, they're just too bad, yenichem v'yelech lo v'yitzav v'achel na'higem k'ra'u lehem. So you get somebody else, hire somebody else. You know, literally, you know, not literally, but it sounds almost from the Rambam. You put them in some kind of nursing home. You put them in a place where somebody else can better take care of them instead of you, because it's driving you crazy. And this is very interesting in terms of the sandwich generation. People know the sandwich generation. Right? You've gone through that probably yourself. It's a very difficult time to be in because you're dealing with your own children, and your children are dealing with you as parents, and now you have to deal with your parents as parents. And they're much more needy sometimes than your children are, depending on the situation. And it becomes increasingly difficult, not only in a practical sense, in terms of what you have to get done for your parent, but in an emotional sense. This is the person that brought you up. This is the person you had a great relationship with. This is the person that you always wanted to have an adult, you know, relationship with. And all of a sudden, they've gone in a different direction mentally, and it's hard to see them in that way. You know, my Ricky's grandfather was a big, you know, popular Rav in Los Angeles. Marvin Sugarman, if people are familiar with the name. He was a rabbi in Shaare Tzedek, for those who know the big shul in the valley in California. So he was a rabbi for 30 years, and then he became somewhat senile. He had Alzheimer's. They moved to Israel, and it's very difficult because the children go to visit him, and he doesn't know who they are. This big rav who used to give drushas from the front of the room, you know, he was able to quote sources and all these things. He doesn't even know his own children, except for my father-in-law, because he was a bit of a troublemaker. So I guess he embedded himself in a little bit more than other kids. But either way, funny stories, by the way, when, you know, you have a rav who went through the system, but, you know, doesn't really act full-time like a rav, but there are sort of semblances of what he used to be like as a rabbi. So I only had the opportunity to really spend the Shabbos with him once, because he lives in Tellstone in Israel. But he always makes the same jokes. You know, all these rabbi jokes. You know, if you ask him how he sleep, how, you know, Zeta, how'd you sleep? He'll go like this. Like this. You know, if you... And then sometimes he'll actually do that, and he'll also say, you know, with my eyes closed, what do you think? You know? But the problem, probably, and you know, it's all of these situations are somewhat humorous and somewhat sad. But he always goes to Minyan every morning by himself. He always knows he has to go to Minyan. You know, that's inspiring. The only caveat to that is that when he goes to shul, and I was there to witness this, when he goes to shul and he finishes Shmona Esrei, so he claps on his bima, on his shtender, because he's trying to tell the chazan that he can start Chazaras Hashatz, because he thinks he's the rabbi, which is somewhat humorous and obviously somewhat sad. But, you know, he doesn't want them to wait any longer, so he's trying to get them to start again. So, but either way, it's very difficult for the children in that situation. So here, when the Rambam says, Vim ef sharlo, you got to think that maybe the Rambam's referring to that kind of situation, that the child finds it very emotionally distressing to see their parent in that way. They've become different people. Nishtatu means they've become, you know, too foolish in a literal sense. So then, you are not strictly obligated to do the acts of kibud av v'im directly, but rather you have somebody else do it. You know, you take care of them from a distance. Which is obviously difficult also in its own way, but you see the sort of the sensitivity, the sort of tension between taking care of a parent and taking care of the child at the same time. Very interesting insight. However, if you look at the Ribid tells us the following. Everyone, I don't know if everyone knows, the Ribid, Rev Avram ben David. Rev Avram ben David was actually he was older than the Rambam, but he was... he was critical of the Rambam. He's known to be the one who always opposed or objected to the Rambam. That's because, you know, he wrote a book which was entirely disagreeing with things that the Rambam said. But the truth is, he agrees with 95% of it. You know, he's just known as the one who always objected to the Rambam. So that's his reputation. We learned about him in Legends and Lessons probably 6 months ago or so. So the Ravid says on this halacha, Misha nitrif adato shel avi v'chul yinichem v'yelechlov yitzava achrem lanhingam karali, that they should ask somebody else to do it. Amr Avram, Aleph here does not mean E-F-Shar, which often it does, but here when it comes to the Ravid, he always starts his statements with Amr Avram, so said Avraham, meaning me, the Ravid. Ein zu hara nechona, you should not do that. Im hu yelech v'yaniach lo l'mi sh'yitzava l'mi yitzava l'shamro. You should not leave your parent. You should always, if you see here, if he goes and leaves him, who shall he command to watch him? Meaning, you might send him to a nursing home, but at that point, it's up to the nursing home to do what they do. You know, it's not like you're actually in charge of the honor that's given to your child, given to your parent. So says the rabbi, you shouldn't do that. And the truth is, we never saw such a situation. However, where can we sort of go back in our neural pathways and remember a possible story where this is the case? Where can you remember this from? Yeah, Viva?
I'm not sure if this is what okay. You're asking, but wasn't there the question of what about living in Eretz Yisrael and you're leaving your parent or your parent lives in Eretz Yisrael? Or,
good.
So who's, how do you...
We had a story. The Gemara told a story about whether or not a certain Amora could leave Eretz Yisrael. Right, he came to his Rebbe and he said, can I leave Eretz Yisrael to go see my mother? And what did we know about that mother? That mother wanted to marry him. Right? She was clearly a little off. She wasn't completely there. And he had asked his Rebbe, can I go there? Ultimately, the Rebbe said, you can, but just come back. But it clearly the Rebbe didn't want him to. The Rebbe said, you know, come back tomorrow. I'll tell you tomorrow. And ultimately, at least according to the mainstream opinion, the Maharsha's view of it, the conventional interpretation of the Gemara, what it meant was that he only allowed him to leave Eretz Yisrael temporarily so that he could come back. Happens to be that he heard that she passed away, but that's irrelevant to this part of the story because it seemed like he had an allowance to leave Eretz Yisrael, but not an obligation to. So maybe that's where the Rambam gets this from, because that Amora left his mother. Literally went to Eretz Yisrael and did not take care of his mother. We had seen in other ways that a person shouldn't go to Eretz Yisrael if it meant to sacrificing the taking care, the care of his parents. So this all comes to a head in terms of more modern ideas, right? As the world has modernized and has sciences and social and societies have become more aware of communal dynamics and interpersonal dynamics. So we've developed a greater sensitivity towards the difficulties of the parent-child relationship. Maybe there have developed more difficulties because of modern living, and therefore more modern thinkers have their own take on some of these things. In source number 10, you'll find Uvda de Rav Asi Hachi Mashma. This was the story of Rav Asi, who I just said left Eretz Yisrael or is going to leave Eretz Yisrael. To go take care of his mother, see his mother. He originally had left his mother to go to Eretz Yisrael. So Ulaihu Sover, Dafka Lemesak Eretz Yisrael, specifically to go to Eretz Yisrael would be allowed. Ve'enu Mechuvar Al Kochach, Vani Omer, says the Yamshal Shlomo, I say personally, Sheyafi Hisigu, that the Ravid is really referring to the story of Ravasi, and the Ravid is correct. The story of Rav Asi is a different story. You can't learn from Rav Asi that you're allowed to leave your mother or your parent if they've gone crazy. Because you know the Rambam that we said maybe the Rambam is basing it on the story of Rav Asi. He says, no, you can't do that. She might have been a little off in that she wanted to marry her child. But she wasn't completely off in that she needed protection. She asked a bad question, right? It wasn't that she was crazy. Meroa halev. It wasn't that she was being evil. And therefore, he went to a place where she wouldn't see him. If, however, she was really in need of guardianship, if she was really in need of help, so then he wouldn't be able to just leave her there. He would have to stay in Chutz Laaretz. He'd have to stay with his mother if she was really, if she had really gone away. And this is presumably in the same sense that we saw by Dhamma Vinasena according to Tosfos in source number 5. That in that sense, if a parent hits you, so then you'd still be obligated if they'd be crazy and if they're in need of your protection. So you're obligated to take care of them. If, however, what's the implication of that Tosfos? If, however, they had really done so, as the Yamshal Shlomo uses the word, Meiroa Halev, right? Very interesting word, very interesting phrase. Meiroa Halev. Resh Vav Ayin Halev. What's Roa Halev? Wickedness of the heart. If the parent was actually doing something out of the wickedness of their heart, so then you would not be obligated. Says the Yamshal Shlomo, that's in neither of these cases. In the case of Moed Katan, or sorry, in the case of Kiddushin in source number 4, that was a case where the woman was actually, you know, had gone off the deep end and she needed to be protected, and Dhamma ben Nisimu was honoring her by not responding to her in public. In the case of Rav Asi, who had left his mother to go to Eretz Yisrael, that also wasn't a case where she needed protection, because she had just asked a silly question. The implication in both is not to say, well, the implication in one of them, by Rav Asi's case, is to say that if she was really, you know, in need of help and assistance, you'd have to stay with her. But she had never done anything particularly abusive. In the case of Dhamma ben Nisena, where his mother strips off his clothing, so then the implication would have been that you're obligated to respect your parents even when they abuse you. Comes Tosfos to say, no, the only reason that Dhamma ben Nisena had respect in his parents was because she had gone off the deep end, she was mentally not there, and therefore he had to respect her because out of the sensitivity and the mercy he had for a parent. But that implies that if a real parent, or not a real parent, but a parent that was all there, was going to hit their child, strip them in public, so then that maybe would be considered meroa halev, the wickedness of their heart, in which case you would not be obligated to respect and to honor the parent in that case. So in that case, in that situation, then we find, at least according to the Yamshal Shlomo, understanding from Tosfos, the only time a person is not obligated in respecting their parent is when it comes, when their activities are meroa halev, wickedness of the heart. So this all comes back to our original question, how do you determine wickedness of the heart? Where is the parent in control, and where is the parent being affected by outside influences? So first of all, just to point out from the Rambam, there might be practical considerations to this question. Even if it's not meroa halev, even if it's not from a wickedness, but it's rather from an impracticality. E'ef shar lo lamod mivnei shnitatu bioser. Source number 8, the Rambam says, if it's just impossible to deal with, maybe it's emotionally impossible, maybe practically impossible. That's a practicality question. That's not an obligatory question. If, however, the situation is not simply a matter of practicality, but a matter of actual wickedness, of abuse, so then there would seem that a person is not obligated towards the parent in any way. There was a conference that I found online, you know, someone who compiled some of these sources for the topic of abusive parents. There was a conference that was put on, I believe, by Nefesh. I think it was by Nefesh, but here it's at a Young Israel Council of Rabbis annual conference. I'm not really sure if we have these anymore. I've never heard of them. None of my colleagues have told me about them. But either way, there was such a thing once upon a time, 21 years ago. And they had Rav David Cohen, who's a posek in Brooklyn. I believe it's in Brooklyn. And he said, this is a transcription of that speech. And he goes through some of these sources. The Gemara tells us where the mother of the Roman officer came and took off his chash of a beged. You gotta bear with the language here. Chash of a beged, meaning it's sort of like the noble garments. And spat at him. So the Tosfos brings that she was miturefes. She was insane. So of course, that has a lot to say. Why the son did not really feel that his mother was embarrassing him. Maybe he felt a tinge of embarrassment, but everyone understood because they saw she was a miturefes. They understood she was a little bit off. But in a situation where a child was sexually abused by a parent, we know it is worse than being a chola, even worse than being sick. A child who has to deal with a parent who sexually abused that child, it's almost to say that that child will never become meshuchrar. Meshuchrar, like to free somebody. Like it's actually this week's parsha. Shachrer is eved. That you free. So they'll never be freed in that kind of situation. It's very difficult to get the damage out. And if the person has to deal with the parent, there are very few people that can possibly do so. So certainly when it comes to sexual abuse, I feel that it is not worse. That it is not worse than a mitzvah where most poskim will tell you that a chola is pater, right? If anyone's sick, so you can forego certain mitzvahs for the sake of healing. We are talking about mitzvahs ase. We are talking about mitzvahs ase now. Just as there is a shear of mitzvahs ad chomesh, just like in order to accomplish a certain mitzvah, this is a fascinating logic. I know he's a little all over the place here, but I'll explain in a second. Well, there are certain mitzvos, well, all mitzvos, if they're positive mitzvos, you only have to spend up to 20% of your income on them, right? Anyone familiar with the, what was that story? The chassid buying the esrog, Ushpizin. People know the movie Ushpizin? Right, so he's a poor, and the family's poor, and they have no money, etc. And he spends like all their money on an esrog. So, obviously, there are other societal critiques of that movie, but there are halachic critiques of that movie because you shouldn't spend that much on an esrog if it's going to bankrupt you from other things for yontif, for your family, and things like that. Right, so there's a cap. The Gemara in Kedushin talks about different places in Kedushin, although it's nearby. There's a cap to the mitzvah. The mitzvah, any mitzvah, should not bankrupt you more than 20% of your income, and that includes a lot of things. although there are commentaries that make exceptions for the rule, whatever. So he says here, in the case of a child who has to be honoring of their parents, so then what's the shear? No, it's not a monetary value, but there's an emotional value. And if the child is giving up more than one-fifth of their emotional well-being, says Rav David Cohen, one is only obligated to spend one-fifth of his assets for a positive commandment. So the post can say, when it is a question of being a chola, that is the same thing. That being a chola is like ad chomesh, so that there is really no chiv to make oneself ill for the sake of kibud av. In this case, the child's emotional well-being can if it's sacrificed more than one-fifth, obviously you have to figure out how to calculate that kind of thing, but if they're sacrificing more than 20% of their emotional well-being, they are not obligated to honor that parent. This is interesting for a number of reasons. Obviously, a lot of things might be racing through our minds in terms of how to calculate that, how to apply that, who's going to determine that. But it's interesting because we had mentioned last week or 2 weeks ago the distinction of the Rush, that there are two things at play. There's the obligation that a person is required or not required to fulfill, and then there's the relevancy to the obligation in the first place. Right, if there's a parent who's completely rebellious to Judaism, so then they're not obligated. It's not osem asa amcha. Here it's saying that there is an obligation, right? The parent is within the realm of obligation. It's just that the child's mentality, the child's mental capacity or emotional well-being is at stake. And therefore they're not going to be obligated to, from the child's perspective, they're not beholden to that mitzvah. Whereas from the parent's perspective, it would seem, at least according to this, that they're still within the realm of the mitzvah, meaning in a theoretical sense. If you had, and this is obviously very theoretical, and I'm not trying to say anything, but for argument's sake, for understanding this for a second, if you had an exceptionally emotionally mature child who had an abusive parent, but the child was able, like Dama Ben Nesina, to basically say, my parent has things that are wrong mentally, I have to stay here, I have to take care of them. If they had that certain sort of superhuman level of emotional maturity, so then you can understand that maybe they would be obligated, according to this logic, right? According to this logic, where it doesn't affect them more than 20% of their mental well-being, again, hard to imagine. But if that were the case, then they'd still be obligated. Whereas we could have said, We could have said that an abusive parent has given up their rights, is no longer deserving of Kibud Av V'Aim from the parent's perspective, from the parent's side of the equation, not from the child's side. And yet Rav David Cohen doesn't say that. So all of these Gemaras seem to point in the same direction, that even by an abusive parent, there is an application or at least a relevancy towards Kibud Av V'Aim, even with an abusive parent. Whether or not the child is obligated from their perspective is a different question. There are always two sides of the story, right? There's the parent's side. From the parent's perspective, they never give up their, you know, deservedness for the mitzvah. At least that's what it seems like from some of these sources. I can imagine other sources say otherwise. But we haven't seen any explicitly in the Gemara, at least. But from the child's perspective, that's different. From the child's perspective about whether the child is able to, we saw from the Rambam in source number 8, that maybe there's an impracticality to it. It's just not, the child's just not able to withstand that situation. And as we saw from Rav David Cohen and explaining maybe in line with the Yom Shel Shlomo, if the parent is too abusive, so then the child is no longer obligated based on their own well-being. Not necessarily learned that from Rav Asi, also not necessarily learned that from Dhamma Ben Nisina, but it would seem that it's within the orbit of relevancy. It's just a matter of whether the child whether it's incumbent upon the child based on the child's well-being. What do we think about that? Adina's not convinced.
No, the 20% is throwing me. It's like, you know, where do you come up with that number?
Right.
I mean, you know, how do you measure that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Know? Exactly. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing when I saw it. Presumably.
Does the 20% really apply? It says he's like, it says that the chola is patur except like, I don't think we have to read it that if you're 20%, more than 20% chola over the situation. I would read it like any amount of, I mean, if you're really that badly affected, whether it's 20% or less, why does
okay.
it have to be a certain percentage? I'm not thinking that.
I guess it would depend on sort of what he means by the statement. I can understand what you're saying in terms of saying that it's too much of a sacrifice. Any sacrifice is too much of a sacrifice, and it's sort of taking the concept of Ad Chomesh as an example of a small sacrifice. You could see that within his words. Obviously, this was a speech, so I'm not really sure he was saying things very specifically and meticulously. But I could see what you're saying in terms of that. But in terms of what Adina is saying, in terms of who's going to judge this, I would assume that would go to a professional, like a therapist of some kind, from the parent's perspective and from the child's perspective. That's going to determine whether this is mentally or emotionally beneficial or detrimental to the child or to the parent to continue on that relationship. That's what I would think. That's how you'd determine it. Yeah, Sarita?
I was just going to say that the damage is irreparable. I mean, there's such consequences, incest or things like that. There's no, I don't see how you can put any...
Yeah, and this comes back to how we sort of... Yeah, this is also comes back to how we started the conversation, which is every situation is different, right? We use the word abuse as sort of like a catch-all, but there are so many different types of abuse. We don't have to list them because I'd rather not talk about them. But, you know, you can think of different types of abuse, and it doesn't just categorize itself within sexual promiscuity or sexual abuse. There are a lot of other types of abuse, too. And everyone has to, every instance has to be dealt with separately. From the parent's perspective also, there has to be a sense of sensitivity. You know, it depends where the parent's coming from. It depends where the kid's coming from. It's not always the case. You know, it's not always the case that that the parent is in the wrong. Sometimes it's the child. We talked about that last week too. Maybe the child is too rebellious. Maybe the child is, has behavioral issues. And even though the parent might be a little bit at fault, they haven't crossed the line of abuse to allow the child to therefore not be obligated in respecting the parent. So every situation is obviously very delicate in this sense. Obviously, you have to go to the professionals. You have to go to the right people to figure out the dynamics. But these are some of the sources that factor into at least the category of whether a parent is still deserving of Kibud Av V'Aim if they are abusive to the child. Yeah, Viva.
Go ahead. So
is Rav David Cohen wasn't talking about halacha per se. He was just talking about a perspective or a suggestion.
Yeah, I don't. Well, he's talking about halacha, but he's not necessarily saying that when it applies. You'd have to take every situation case by case to see whether this concept applies. The fact that there is such a concept is what he's saying. Maybe you would think that there isn't some kind of allowance to forego the mitzvah of Kibud Av. He's saying, no, there are situations where you could, based on the emotional well-being of the child. Yeah, Dina?
I was just thinking, and this is coming out of left field maybe, but this whole situation with, what's his name, Dama Ben Natina.
Yeah.
It seems almost like a situation where, you know, to me, similar to when you read the stories of Gedolim, the books about Gedolim, and,
yeah,
you know, because how many of us could say they would be able to sit there, right, and do nothing? So it seems like that, you know, an example that's so far-fetched that we can't relate to.
Yeah, that could be. It's interesting, the Gemara, the Gedolim story example. But yeah, no, it could be one of the, and as I said, it's not necessarily clear that this is trying to teach us the level of our obligation. It could just be teaching us an aspiration, right? It's sort of teaching us, right? It's not even that the Gemara is telling us that is what we have to do. But yeah, you're right. It depends on the situation. I don't know if the Gemara is even saying that one would be obligated in it, right? According to at least the way that the Yamshal Shlomo understands the Rambam, in source number 8, that could be exactly what the Rambam means when he says, Misha nitrif adato shel aviv o shel imo mishtad linhog imam, you have to try to do your best with your parent, v'im ef shelo, but if you just can't do it, so then, you know, you're allowed to pass off the buck, you give it to somebody else. You know, so maybe that's what the Rambam is saying, that this Gemara about Dama ben Natina is exactly saying that, you know, if you have extra human strength that you're able to, so then you can do it as much as you can. But EF Shar, so then you just a practical matter, you can't do it. I think you're right about that. It's not 100% clear whether we're obligated in the same situation as Dama ben Natina was. It could be one of those, take the pulse of it and see what you have to do in response.
He wasn't even Jewish, was he?
No, but the Gemara quotes him as an example of Kibud Avim. The question is, why is the Gemara quoting him, right? Right. We're not saying that he's postening or anything, but the Gemara is bringing it as an example to teach us something. Yeah. All right, we'll see what we do next week. People interested in a Purim primer? I was thinking about this recently. People want, like, halachas of Purim, especially with COVID, about what to do. Maybe we can take a week off. Open it up to the rest of the shul, just because this is sort of like the halacha slot. Maybe we can do something like that for a week.
That's fine. That sounds good.
Take a week break, get a little bit of a brush up. I know, like, sometimes people come to me, like, the morning of Purim, like, how do you do that again? You know, like, what am I supposed to do? Megillah, do I have to listen to it? Do I have to fast? Do I have to do this? Like, maybe just going through some of the halachas so that people are familiar with it before getting to the day could be helpful. So I think that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a week break and do some halachas of Purim.
Thank you.
All righty. Everyone should be well. We'll pick up with Kibud Av in 2 weeks. Mirzah Hashem.
Have a good night, everyone.
Be well. Have a good night.